gave a short 20-minute talk on climate change and capitalism, then there's going to be discussion. And then another 20-minute talk on money and...
The Dharma of Money, Economics, and Livelihood.
Okay.
You can do whatever you want, though.
Yeah. Well, what I'd like to do is combine those two. So okay. Maybe talk for approximately half an hour, and then that leaves us at least half an hour for discussion.
Great.
Yeah. Climate change and capitalism. Well, the first thing is, it's harder and harder in my mind to distinguish climate change from the larger ecological crisis. So what I have to say won't focus on climate change at all, but the whole question about the relationship between the kind of ecological situation that we find ourselves in now and capitalism. And the big question, of course, is how much can the ecological challenge be resolved with the kind of economic and political framework we have, and how much can we see the ecological crisis as actually a symptom of something that's much deeper, in particular the way that our economic system functions. Yeah. I suppose for those especially interested in that, the recent publication of Naomi Klein's, right, This Changes Everything, I think that's a really important book. And I just read this morning, there's a film that's about to be released later this month, which I think is probably going to be about the same sorts of themes. So, in order to talk about capitalism, I think it's necessary to begin by making a few distinctions, right? So, I would define capitalism as an economic system where production is engaged in for the sake of profit, as opposed to, say, a subsistence-type economy, such as is what we had in most parts of the world for a very long time, or a kind of socialist economy where the government basically controls production and controls then distribution. So production's engaged in for the sake of profit. That needs to be distinguished from corporations, consumerism, and industrial growth. I mean, actually, those are incredibly overlapping, and what I have to say is going to apply to most of them most of the time. But I think we still need to make the distinction, right? So capitalism, originally, when it began, there were no corporations or megacorporations. If you go back to Adam Smith, the great theorist of capitalism and the wealth of nations, he was very suspicious of corporations. Not only him, our founding fathers were very suspicious of corporations. So we happen to have corporate capitalism, but that's not inherent within the basic concept. Consumerism, that's another aspect of it. Again, consumerism, we can conceive of a kind of capitalism that doesn't emphasize consumerism in the way that we do. Maybe it's hard to conceive of it, just because we're so used to that now, right? I tend to think of consumerism, frankly, as a kind of contemporary religion. That if we understand religion as what tells us what's really important about the world and how to live in the world, I think consumerism is the most successful religion of all time, winning more converts more quickly than any other religion ever has. A false religion in the sense that all religions sort of, in some way, promise to show us how to live so that we will be happy. And the problem with consumerism, as I think we all know, is that it's always an unfulfilled promise. It's always the next thing you buy that's going to make you happy. And the other distinction that I want to make, so having distinguished capitalism, corporations, consumerism, and industrial growth, again, there have been very recently a couple very important economic systems that were not capitalist, but that were very preoccupied with industrial growth. Think of the Soviet Union, and until recently China. Both of those were really concerned about industrial growth. And for what it's worth, both of them are far more polluted than the United States, which is very interesting. So just to recap, what I'm trying to do is distinguish capitalism per se from corporations, consumerism, and industrial growth. But, of course, what we have now, what we're dealing with, in a way, all of those things overlap. We have corporate consumerism, corporate consumer capitalism that's preoccupied with growth, such that if it doesn't continue to grow in its present form, it tends to collapse. Right? Now, for those of us who want a straight kind of Naomi Klein critique, we can go to her, but what I'd like to offer is a couple different Buddhist perspectives, and I don't mean these to be the Buddhist perspective, but it seems to me they are very important Buddhist perspectives, or perspectives that, as far as I'm concerned, if we understand Buddhist teachings, that Buddhism seems to suggest these kind of critiques. And the first part is a kind of double-barreled critique of how consumerism works in terms of the individual, but also how the corporate system works in terms of institutions. So in other words, I want to do two things. I want to link Buddhist teachings with consumerism, and I want to link Buddhist teachings with the kind of present capitalist preoccupation with economic growth. If that's not clear, don't worry. Hopefully it will when I kind of unpack it. But let me just check. Is everyone with me okay? Can you understand my English well enough? Am I talking too fast or too slow? So let me start with the consumer critique. It seems to me the most important teaching of the Buddha, that is to say, the teaching that speaks most directly to me, and I think to our time, is the connection that the Buddha makes between dukkha, suffering in the broadest sense of the term, and anatta, or not-self. Right? I mean, dukkha is definitely the most important term, especially in early Buddhism. The Buddha said, right, what he has to teach is dukkha and how to end it. If you think of the Four Noble Truths, they're all about dukkha. And there are many different types of dukkha, but one of the ones that's very much emphasized in Buddhist teachings is the connection between dukkha and the delusion of a separate self. And the way that I sometimes talk about it is to say that as long as we have this delusion of separation, the delusion that there's a me inside that's separate from all of you and the rest of the world outside, as long as there's this delusion of separation, inherent to that, built into that, is a kind of subtle or not so subtle dukkha, suffering. We can go into why that's the case. Fundamentally, I think the way I tend to express it is that in more contemporary terms, the sense of self is a construct that, because it's a construct, is inherently insecure. It's not only insecure, it can't be secured, because there's nothing there. It's a construct. It's a way of functioning. It's the way a bunch of physical and mental processes work together. But because there's no reality, there's no real David Lloyd, there's no thing there, there's a fundamental anxiety underlying that. Or as I sometimes say, the sense of self is haunted or shadowed by a sense of lack. And where the fundamental problem tends to occur is that we don't realize this. I think we all have the sense of lack. We all have the sense something is wrong with me, something is wrong with my life. But we don't know where that comes from. And what tends to happen, and I think this is kind of a fundamental inversion, the fundamental ignorance is that we tend to project it. We think, what I'm lacking is something outside myself. According to the kind of culture that I've been socialized into, or the kind of personality type I am, there's something out here that I don't have enough of, and if only I get enough of it, then I will be okay. And I think this is something that we're, all of us, pretty much more or less stuck in, thinking. Our lives aren't working well enough, they're not as good as they can be or should be, because there's something out here that I don't have. And it's not to deny that there are things out here that we need, for sure. But the fundamental idea that the basic problem is if I just get enough of this and enough of that, or get rid of this, if I just solve all these problems, then everything will be okay. That's the fundamental delusion. It doesn't work like that. It's the nature of our unawakened minds to be bothered by something because they're inherently insecure. So, in our culture, we're conditioned, of course, in certain ways to understand what it is that we like. One of the main ones, of course, I mean, if you grow up in the United States, I think we learn pretty quickly what it is that we like, right? We don't have enough money, is, I think, a pretty standard. We're not enough consumer toys, right? Add to that a very sophisticated system of advertising, and I think you can see where I'm going with this. On the one hand, we have this fundamental sense of lack, this fundamental dukkha, built into the sense of separate self. And on the other hand, we have an economic system that's constantly seducing us, that constantly wants to resolve our problem by encouraging us to buy this or buy that and buy that. So there's an almost perfect fit between the fundamental problem that I think Buddhism is talking about and the kind of consumerism that we in the United States are caught up in. Such that, again, as I said, we're encouraged to understand the problem of our lives in those terms. And I think that's the problem with consumerism. Insofar as consumerism is what I call a false religion, it can never deliver what it promises. And this is the context in which I think we can understand why Buddhism is so important, or not just Buddhism, but I think any genuine spiritual tradition that tends to take us away from obsession with consumerism, finding something out here, and instead encourages us to sort of go inside and to deal directly with the delusion of a separate self. Does this make any sense? Mm-hmm. So this is my first critique from a Buddhist perspective, that we have a flawed system that preys upon a fundamental weakness. Praise in an unhealthy way because it doesn't really resolve the problem. It just uses us to make money by constantly finding ways to want us to buy more and more things. And that's not to say that I don't love my iPhone, right? I mean, that's not to say that consumerism isn't wonderful in certain ways, but as a trap, as sort of that's the main meaning of my life, it's very, very dangerous, I think. Because, of course, in order to consume, well, even the word consume, right? Like a fire consumes. The whole point of consumerism is that we consume things, but in the process of manufacturing those things that we consume, the earth is consumed, right? The resources of the earth are consumed. That's my first point. Point number two, what I said so far is on the individual level, but I also think we have a institutional issue here, right? Buddhism talks a lot about what are sometimes called the three poisons. Anybody remember what they are?
Greed, hatred, and delusion.
Sure. Greed, hatred, ill will, aversion, delusion. Great. Okay. I think we have a new problem that the Buddha didn't face in his time. I think given that we have much more complex and sophisticated institutions, we have institutionalized greed. And to institutionalize it, it means that actually greed has taken on a life of its own, quite apart from the individual motivations or intentions of the people involved. And this is really important. Essential to the Buddha's spiritual revolution was his emphasis on intentionality, the intention behind what we do. And, you know, we can understand karma in those terms. If what I do is motivated by greed, aversion, delusion, problems are going to tend to occur. And how important it is then to transform our fundamental motivations from greed to generosity, from aversion to loving kindness or basic friendliness, and from delusion to the wisdom that acknowledges our interdependence, right? Not just our interdependence as human beings, but our interdependence with the whole earth. For the moment, I only want to talk about the first institutionalization. I think that the basic way that our economic system is structured is that it institutionalizes greed. And I think the best way to spell that out is to look at the way the stock market functions. On the one hand, if we look at the one side of the stock market, what do we have? We have millions and millions of investors. Why do they invest in the market? Well, if you have a little extra money, that's one place to put it. You're hopeful that that's where you will get better returns, certainly better returns than you get from bank accounts or most other things these days, right? And of course, the people doing this, I mean, they're not bad people. That is something that's conditioned by our society. In fact, we make kind of cultural icons out of the great investors. The sage of Omaha, Warren Buffett, he's a kind of culture hero, isn't he? You know, because he's done so well at investing, right?
And divesting.
And divesting, yeah. They know how to buy and sell at the right time.
No, but he also has come to this wisdom of giving it all away before he dies.
Well, we'll come back to
that
too.
Right, okay.
Right. But in terms of the way the system operates, that's what I'm concerned about.
Yeah.
Right? So I guess the point I want to emphasize is the concern to put your money in the stock market is I mean, there's nothing evil about that. That's just part of the way that our economic system works, right? And the truth is, almost all of us are implicated one way or the other. I mean, if we have pensions, if we have a lot of times we don't know where the money is, mutual funds and all that. So, but look at it from this point. So on the one hand, that's the kind of input. But if you look at the other side of the stock market, there's also the output. What is the consequence of all of these investments?
I love my iPhone.
So on the one hand, we have all of these people investing. And, you know, why do they invest? For the most part, it's not because they want to make the world a better place, right? They invest because you expect a return on investment. Mm-hmm. But put all those millions and millions of investors and mutual funds and, corporations together and translate that into the other side of the equation. And what it really becomes is a unremitting pressure that every CEO feels on the other side to maximize profitability, return on investment, preferably in the next quarterly report. In other words, there's this extraordinary pressure to return profit. You want to have you want the stock prices to go up. You want the dividends to be high because your company is making a lot of money. So there's this unremitting pressure. But again, the pressure is not to make the world a better place. The pressure is to maximize profits, right? The pressure is to grow, for the most part. Right? Who's responsible for the way this system works? See, this is where it gets at the institutionalization. The other thing I forgot to mention, of course, is in the process of every CEO wanting to maximize profitability, of course, if he can externalize some of the costs. In other words, if you can pollute, if you're a mining company and you can pollute something without having to clean it up, well, that just means that you've had more profit for yourself. So there's always this concern inside and outside, you know. The urge for profitability is always a kind of a challenge. How do you deal with what we might consider externalities? Again, who's responsible for this? Well, quickly, think, for example, of the CEO of a large energy firm. Let's say ExxonMobil. Suppose he wakes up, I'm going to say he because it's almost always a he. Suppose he wakes up one morning and suddenly he's gone green. He's had some awakening and he realizes what's happening to the earth and he's really concerned now to do everything that he can, and he's concerned that his company should do everything that they can. But if the things that he tries to do negatively affect profitability in any way, what's likely to happen to him?
Job loss.
Yeah. Well, think about what that means.
Maybe he'll be happier.
Well, happier. Hopefully he has enough savings that he doesn't have to worry about that, you know. But if that's true for the CEO at the top of the corporate pyramid, think how much more true it is for everyone else down the line. See, my point here, we have a system that encourages maximization of profit quite apart from the individual motivations of the people involved. A system where the focus on continual growth, where not only consumers never consume enough, but stock prices are never high enough, dividends are never high enough, GDP is never big enough. That to me is a definition of greed, or one definition of greed. And it's the way the system is structured, not only individually in terms of consumers wanting more, but just in terms of the way that the anonymity of the stock market and the kind of collective pressure of investors on corporations for profitability, how that creates a kind of fundamental problem for the earth. And not only for the earth, but you could say, I mean, for our societies as a whole, if you think about the other things that corporations are encouraged to do in order to, again, maximize profitability. So you'll have a town like Flint or Detroit, Michigan, where suddenly everyone's out of work and the town is destroyed because the production can be sent across the border to Mexico and produce more cheaply. In other words, the social needs and social stability, social health is subordinate to the role of the corporation. It's like the corporate growth is what's primary, and society has to kind of fit in as best it could. And it wasn't always this way. It wasn't always this way. And, you know, prior to the modern era, there were lots of social restraints on markets. Right? So, does that make any sense? That to me is the double-barrel critique. On the one hand, the problem with individual consumers playing to our sense of lack, and on the other hand, a kind of institutional deformation such that without anyone in particular being responsible, we have a system that I would say maximizes greed and, again, takes on a life of its own. The motivation, that's what I mean by institutionalization, the motivation has taken on a life of its own. But let me make one more argument and then I'll shut up, for a while anyway. Let me go back to that definition of capitalism. Anybody remember what I said?
A system designed for profit, for right. Making profit.
Production is profit. Engaged in for the sake of profit. So let me look at a particularly interesting example. The example of a large Japanese corporation called Mitsubishi. As you may know, Japanese love sushi and sashimi raw fish, and their favorite is bluefin tuna. By far. Unfortunately, bluefin tuna is a very endangered species. What they're finding is, what they're catching, it's more difficult to catch and they're getting smaller, of course. In other words, it's the typical endangered species phenomenon. So Mitsubishi has come up with a very clever solution to this. What they've done is, and again, I don't know if they sent out their own trawlers or if they simply bought up all the stock that was available and encouraged the boats to get more. But basically, they have bought up as many bluefin tuna as they can and frozen them in their massive freezers in Tokyo at minus 60 degrees because as bluefin tuna becomes more and more endangered or even commercially extinct, the value of their frozen tuna will go up astronomically. That's what they do. Now, you probably have the same, I can see many of you have the same reaction that I do, right? I mean, there's something immoral about that. And yet, from a strict economic point of view, it makes a lot of sense.
But there's creativity in it, too.
Yeah, there you go, creativity.
There is, really.
And there's also
it's
the other
quite
side
brilliant.
Of it.
Yeah.
The other side of it is if they don't do it, probably somebody else will. It's what they call the tragedy of the commons, right?
Right.
Nonetheless, I think this really is an excellent example of precisely the problem, where if production is engaged in for the sake of profit, what it means is that profit, of course, is the end, the goal, and production, whether it's bluefin tuna or anything else in the ocean or the forests or the air, all of that becomes a means to the end, you see. And that's where it gets very, very tricky. Let me just say a quick word here about money. Because I want to point out to what I think is a kind of a fundamental paradox or ironic contradiction. What's money? In and of itself, as I think you probably know, money is a nothing. That is to say, those bills in your pocket and numbers in your digital bank accounts. You can't eat those bills, or, you know, you can't breathe them, you can't ride them, you can't sleep under them. They're symbols. In other words, money is a social construct, an essential and a wonderful social construct, right? It enables us to exchange one thing for another, but it's basically a construct. Money, although in and of itself having no value whatsoever, we define it as the most valuable thing of all, because we can exchange it for anything, almost anything, as we know. The tricky thing, of course, is that insofar as we have a sense of lack, there tends to be a kind of distortion to this process, such that lack, so that money isn't simply a means of exchange or even a storehouse of value, but lack actually plugs into it, and money comes to symbolize something. If it's the case that with money we can buy almost anything, if we can satisfy almost any desire, and if satisfying desires is how we unreflectively define what it means to be happy, then money comes to symbolize, in our culture, and for most of us individually, money comes to symbolize the possibility of happiness. And if you've got quite a bit of money but you're not happy, the way it works is, obviously, you don't have enough money, right? That's the way that we are, you know, to a large extent, encouraged to think, and that's why it's so important to become rich and super rich. Okay, so you see my point. Money is in itself a nothing. What's everything else? Remember the definition of capitalism. Production is engaged in for the sake of profit. Profit is what? Profit is money. Profit is money. And in an important sense, the money is nothing except insofar as it can translate into something of value. But here's the incredible irony, I think. As the example of Mitsubishi Corporation shows us, the way the present system is structured, we are encouraged to create everything, to understand and use and manipulate everything else in the natural world as a means in order to maximize the end, what? Profit, money. Mm-hmm. In other words, we are encouraged to consume everything in the natural world. All the things, again, this is an exaggerated stereotype, but the point, I think you can see. We are encouraged to treat everything in the natural world, the oceans and everything in it, all the trees, the clean water, everything, we are encouraged to perceive that as the means to maximize the end of profitability. In other words, and here's the punchline, the way the present system works, we are encouraged to sacrifice everything of real value for something that in and of itself has no value whatsoever. Does that make any sense?
No.
Well, you'll have a chance to come back. Yeah. So that's the kind of paradox that I think we're stuck into now. If indeed production is engaged in, you know, for the sake of profit. And I've totally lost track of the time.
You're perfectly on time. You're a few minutes early.
Okay. Well, what else was I going to say? There was something else I was going to stick on the bottom of that. But I think I'll have chances to come back. So just to summarize very quickly. Initially, a two-pronged Buddhist critique. Number one, consumerism plugs in perfectly to this sense of lack that I think we all have, due to the delusion of separate self. We're always trying to secure the separate self. And consumerism, therefore, grabs that and manipulates that, not in a way that's ever going to make us happy, but in a way to maximize profitability. Secondly, I think that our economic system institutionalizes greed insofar as we never have enough. And institutionalizes, the important point here is that when I say institutionalizes, the motivation that the Buddha specified, right? He mentions these three poisons, these three roots of evil. He's basically saying, These are, you know, he's not, in Buddhism we don't talk about a Satan or a devil or whatever. Mm-hmm. The Buddha says, when there's problems, look at these three. When we're motivated by greed, ill will, delusion, and I think the situation we're in now is that we have really maximized, we have an economic system that institutionalizes that motivation. The motivation takes on a life of its own, given the way the corporation is structured, given the way it's owned by the shareholders, and it has to, you know, satisfy their demands for profitability. It's institutionalized in a way so that no one in particular has any responsibility. It just sort of goes on its own way. It takes on this life of its own. And finally, I've sort of zoomed in on this issue of means and ends of production for the sake of profit by looking at the example of Mitsubishi Corporation and bluefin tuna as a way of making what I think is the weirdest, paradoxical, most ironic point of all, that I think the kind of economic system we have is encouraging us to use up and consume everything in order to maximize something that in and of itself is a nothing. And if there's a better critique of capitalism, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Enough for me.
You nailed it with that.
I want to make a suggestion at this
point. Thank you.
Please, Bonnie.
Because we are a group of 20, I want